The Clash of the Two Americas, Volume 1, The Unfinished Symphony, was written by Matthew Arrett and Cynthia Chung and published by the Canadian Patriot Press. This recording is narrated by Hugh Patrick Trudeau. Chapter 8, Lincoln and the Greenbacks. Before plunging into the story of Lincoln's assassination and the British efforts to break up the Union through civil war, let us take a moment to explore the mind and strategic thinking of Abraham Lincoln in a bit more detail. What did Lincoln actually face? Beyond the dangers of secession, Lincoln had to contend with the Wall Street financiers and Anglophile families who worked tirelessly to sabotage the president's ability to acquire the funds necessary to execute the war. To make matters worse, the state of economic affairs was completely unmanageable, with over 7,000 recognized banknotes in the USA and over 1,496 banks each issuing multiple notes. Under this highly deregulated system, brought about by the 1836 killing of the National Bank years earlier under Andrew Jackson, and the passage of the 1846 Independent Treasury Act that prevented the government from influencing economic affairs, every private bank could issue currencies with no federal authority. With such a breakdown of finances, no national projects were possible. International investments were scarce, and free market money worshipping ran rampant. Manufacturing collapsed, speculation took over, and the slavocracy grew in influence between the 1837 bank panic and 1860. The city of London was obviously not interested in allowing the USA to get out from underwater, and, with the gold-backed pound sterling, ensured the manipulation of gold prices and orchestrated the buyout of U.S. gold reserves. When Lincoln sought loans to execute the war, whether from Wall Street or international banking houses, the loans were granted only at excessive interest rates of 20 to 25%. Russian ambassador to London, de Brunau, reported to Moscow of England's desire to break the Union, writing in January 1861, "The English government, at the bottom of its heart, desired the separation of North America into two republics, which will watch each other jealously and counterbalance one the other. Then England, on terms of peace and commerce with both, would have nothing to fear from either, for she would dominate them, restraining them by their rival ambitions." Historian Robert Ingraham described this impossible situation in 2002. In January 1862, Gallatin, the head of the New York Associated Banks, presented the banker's ultimatum to the Treasury. 1. Pay for the war effort through a massive increase of direct taxation of the population. 2. Deposit all U.S. government gold in the private New York banks and make those banks the sole monopoly agent for the marketing of U.S. government debt, primarily bonds sold in London. 3. Suspend the sub-treasury laws, government regulation of banks. And 4. Withdraw all government-issued paper currency so that only gold and private banknotes would circulate as currency. 150 years of revisionist historians have obscured the real Lincoln and the true nature of the Civil War as a British-run operation to undo the Revolution of 1776. The demonstrable fact is that the martyred president was always an opponent of slavery and always situated himself in the traditions of the American system of Hamilton, describing in 1832 a policy which he enacted 30 years later. "My politics are short and sweet, like the old woman's dance. I am in favor of a national bank. I am in favor of the internal improvement system and a high protective tariff. These are my sentiments and political principles." In 1839, Lincoln campaigned vigorously for the election of Hamiltonian Whig candidate William Harrison and delivered dozens of speeches in support of the nationalist president. The guiding theme among these speeches was the need to revive the Hamiltonian National Bank, which had just recently been killed by Burr's political machine then running the presidency of Andrew Jackson. Lincoln's most famous speech in defense of rechartering the National Bank, made on December 26, 1839, was circulated nationwide and played a major role in Harrison's victory of 1840. Sadly, upon Harrison's mysterious death in office only 3 months into his first term, the bill to revive the bank that had passed the House of Representatives never made it into law, and instead, Burr's machine took back control, sending the U.S. on a trajectory towards dissolution. It was at the end of this speech that Lincoln exhibited a prophetic understanding of the inevitable war that would soon emerge if the issue of slavery and sovereign controls over finance could not be resolved. "I know that the great volcano at Washington, aroused and directed by the evil spirit that reigns there, is belching forth the lava of political corruption in a current broad and deep, which is sweeping with frightful velocity over the whole length and breadth of the land, bidding fair to leave unscathed no green spot or living thing, while on its bosom are riding, like demons on the waves of hell, the imps of that evil spirit, and fiendishly taunting all those who dare to resist its destroying course with the hopelessness of their effort. And knowing this, I cannot deny that all may be swept away. Broken by it, I too may be. Bow to it, I never will. The probability that we may fall in the struggle ought not to deter us from the support of a cause we believe to be just. It shall not deter me." In 1859, Lincoln described himself in the following terms. "I was an old Henry Clay tariff Whig. In old times, I made more speeches on that subject than on any other. I have not since changed my views." From this period in the Congress, where he became a leading ally of John Quincy Adams and played a leading role in opposition to the unjust U.S.-Mexican War, Lincoln committed himself consistently to ending not only systems of slavery, but also all hereditary international power structures which he understood were inextricably connected, saying during an 1858 debate with the slavocracy's Judge Douglas, "That is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent. It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. They are the two principles that have stood face to face from the beginning of time and will continue ever to struggle. The one is the common right of humanity, and the other, the divine right of kings." The means needed to break both systems, of empire and of slavery, were located in the American system of political economy. Lincoln revives the American system. Putting this economic policy into action during the height of the war occurred in a three-step operation, which began with the Banking and Currency Acts in 1862 and 1863. These acts placed the thousands of local state banks under a federal charter with federal supervision for the first time in decades. By imposing a 10% tax on state banknotes, private independent state banks shrank from 1,466 in 1861 to only 297 by 1865. And over 1,630 national banks took their place. The Bank Act of 1863 established reserve requirements for the first time, and also capped the interest rates in order to destroy usury within the nation itself. In order to eliminate international interference and manipulation from Wall Street financiers, the Bank Act also forced 75% of all bank directors to reside in the state in which the bank was located, and all directors had to be American citizens. The most important step in this fight was the sovereign control of credit issuance, which, according to Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, can only be effected through the U.S. Treasury. This should be an important lesson for anyone serious about ending the privately run Federal Reserve controls over national finance today. Following this constitutional principle, Lincoln issued a new form of currency called greenbacks, which could only be issued against U.S. government bonds. These began being issued with the 1862 Legal Tender Act. Nationally chartered banks were now obliged to deposit the Federal Treasury an amount equal to at least one-third of their capital in exchange for government notes issued by the Mint and Treasury. In order to qualify for the federal charters needed to avoid the tax on state bank activities, banks found themselves lending to the government, which gave Lincoln an ability to avoid the usurious loans from London and Wall Street. New bonds were issued under this scheme, called 5/20 bonds, due to their 5 to 20 year maturation, that citizens purchased as investments in their nation's survival. These bonds, which united personal self-interest with the general welfare of the nation, provided loans to manufacturing as well as serving as the basis for the issuance of more greenbacks. Organized by Lincoln's ally, Jay Cook, a patriotic Philadelphia banker, the 5/20 bonds were sold in small denominations to average citizens who then had a vested interest in directly participating in saving their nation. Between 1862 and 1865, these bonds accounted for $1.3 billion. Lincoln described the success of this new approach to finance, saying, "The patriotism of the people has placed at the disposal of the government the large means demanded by its public exigencies. Much of the national loan has been taken by citizens of the industrial classes, whose confidence in their country's faith and zeal for their country's deliverance from present peril has induced them to contribute to the support of the government the whole of their limited acquisitions. This fact imposes peculiar obligations to economy in disbursement and energy in action." These measures were accompanied by a strong protective tariff to grow American industries as well. By the beginning of 1865, $450 million in greenbacks were issued, making up over half of all currency in circulation. Greenbacks and 5/20 bonds financed not only the arming, feeding, and payments to soldiers, but also the often overlooked large-scale industrial and rail programs begun during the peak of the war itself, namely the Transcontinental Railway. Construction started in 1863 and was completed in 1869, linking for the first time in history a continent from east to west, and thus liberating it from British East India monopolies on maritime shipping. This was financed through grants and subsidies made possible by the greenbacks, which increased government spending power by 300%. In his 1865 essay, "How to Outdo England Without Fighting Her," Lincoln's economic advisor, Henry C. Carey, stated, "The greenback has fallen on the country as the dew falls, bringing with it good to all and doing injury to none." Unfortunately, the subversion of Lincoln's American system began quickly with Lincoln's murder. Rather than impose full reconstruction of the defeated South after the war, as Lincoln planned, a new war was waged against greenbacks led by the City of London and its American agents in Wall Street, which ultimately subverted American productive credit with the 1871 Specie Resumption Act. This act killed the greenbacks and tied the Republic's currency to gold, submitting the nation to London's speculative controls while withdrawing credit from large-scale long-term infrastructure projects. In his 1865 inaugural address, Lincoln's treacherous vice president, Andrew Johnson, attacked protectionism and said, "Free trade with all the markets of the world is the true theory of government." Contemplating the international scope of the Civil War, Lincoln stated in 1862, "Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the last generation. We say we are for the Union. The world will not forget that we say this. We know how to save the Union. The world knows we know how to save it. We, even here, hold the power and bear the responsibility. In giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free, honorable alike in what we give and what we preserve. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. Other means may succeed. This could not fail. The way is plain, peaceful, generous, and just, a way which, if followed, the world will forever applaud and God must forever bless. If we do this, we shall not only have saved the Union, but we shall have so saved it as to make and to keep it forever worthy of the saving. We shall have so saved it that the succeeding millions of free, happy people the world over shall rise up and call us blessed to the latest generations.